crazy. I don't dream, so I got nothing. I didn't have a dream about you guys this morning. It's just blackout when I sleep. That's just. Well, growing up, I grew up in the thumb of. Thank you to whoever did this. That's nice. I grew up in the thumb of Michigan going to school. And if you ask my wife who grew up here, it's kind of a cult because no one ever actually like drives through the thumb. You have to go there with a purpose, and so they can recognize outsiders very, very soon. I'm just kidding. But I had a couple interesting things happen in my childhood. It was far from maybe average, and I was always not this big guy. I wasn't strong. I didn't have much going for me. I was scrawny. But the one thing I usually did was my mouth got me into trouble a lot, and I attracted the attention of guys much larger, built like refrigerators, usually in my life. And I wanted to share quick three stories about three different guys in my life this morning as we get started. There was Tom. Now, Tom, it was in elementary school when I was walking back from school when I first met Tom, and he was a big guy, and he would grab like sticks, okay, like tree branches, and break them over his leg and laugh and think it was funny. And I was like, that could be my face. So I always kept my distance from Tom, but like we were in the same vicinity a lot. And I remember one day we were playing pickup football in the schoolyard. One of my friends threw his football to me and it went off my hands, went out of the schoolyard, and the teacher's aide wouldn't let us go get it. A discussion, a disagreement broke out between the two of us. And pretty soon all I knew was Tom was there picking up this other kid and putting him out over on the other side of the fence. And he's like, if it means that much, go get your football. And all of us like scrawny kids are like, woo, good job, Tom. And like, little did we know we'd have to like sit on this like 4-inch wide like park bench for a week because of our shenanigans, I guess. But I was always scared of Tom. And then like for a while, I kind of like was okay. I hit a growth spurt early in junior high and I was a little bit bigger. But then I get to high school. In my sophomore year, there's actually two different guys that I interacted with that I was afraid of. But I didn't show it to them. And so the first one was Ricky. And Ricky was in geometry class and he always sat behind me and he'd flick my ears or he'd smack me, or if the teacher really wasn't looking, he'd get his one finger out and just hit me right in the arm and it tense up and it spasm and I'd be like freaking out. My teacher would be like, what are you doing? But one day he had really big ears. And I was like, I got this. I usually didn't know the answer in geometry class, but this time I did. And I raised my hand, my teacher turns around, and I'm like, Ricky, you look like the Keebler elf. And he goes, boom, it hits me so hard, and I fall out of the chair. But the teacher just turned around, and he saw it, and he got suspended. I wasn't proud of that moment, but I felt like I had won. And I can be honest with you guys and tell you that. But I was really scared when he came back to school. I didn't think that far. But like he gave me a handshake, and he's like, we're good. And I was like, okay, let's go with that. And then in the same year, there was John. And John had gotten into a fight earlier that summer. And the cops, this guy was so strong, they had literally identified his fists as lethal weapons. And I got to be his like his instrument of like fun in gym class. Like we had this athletic training class, so it was for freshmen through senior year kids that were in sports all year round, and they were really trying to focus on those athletes. And so every day he'd just throw me into the locker or like all these different things, and he'd just pick me up by my neck and think it was like fun, and I just struggled there. Until one day he was just like, you know what? You always have a good attitude. And I'm like, that's not how I feel, John, but that's cool. Anyways, I got over that and I earned a lot of respect. But from the time that we're kids, we're conditioned, and it's this dog-eat-dog world, you have to be tough enough, you have to be strong enough to handle whatever throws at you. And the primary goal of childhood, sum it up, our big goal is don't die, stay alive. It's that simple. But the only problem is, as we get older, we start to realize that we're not strong enough. We're not tough enough for whatever life throws at us. We go visit somebody in hospice. And if you've ever been in hospice, you realize that that's hard. It's hard to watch people and their body break down. You see cancer take over somebody's body towards the end of their life, and you realize maybe I'm not strong enough, or I'm not tough enough, or I don't know enough for what life throws at me. Kind of reminds me of the joke. And maybe you guys have heard it, between the Catholic priest, the Pentecostal preacher, and the Jewish rabbi? No? All right, well, I'll tell it to you anyways. We'll get there. So they're in this heated debate one day about the Bible, and they're going back and forth, and as you can understand, they had a difference about their belief system. And finally, the Catholic priest, he just calls time out. He says, guys, we're never going to settle this, but I have an idea. We're going to go in the woods, and the first one of us that can convert a grizzly bear, like, obviously God has blessed them and God is on their side. And they agree, because sometimes those in ministry are just crazy, I guess. But they go out there, and the Catholic priest, since it was his idea, he goes first, and he comes back out of the woods, and he's got a big claw mark across his face, and they're like, what happened? And he's like, well, I sprinkled holy water on the bear, and it just went nuts. Like, it just freaked out. And, like, so I don't recommend doing that. And so the Pentecostal preacher decides he's going to go next, and he comes out, and he's kind of got some bruises and some cuts, and he's got a broken arm, but other than that, he can walk out of the woods. And they're like, how'd it go? And he's like, well, I laid hands on the bear, and I tried to heal him, but he freaked out. He wasn't liking that. And so now the Jewish rabbi's going in, and he's pretty confident, because obviously God wasn't with these other two guys, so surely he's going to get the blessing. And man, he can barely walk out, like, broken leg, broken arms, like, he's in bad shape, cuts and bruises all over, and they're like, man, what happened? And he's like, don't ever try to circumcise a grizzly bear. It just doesn't work out. All right, that's a bad idea. And so far, this sermon's been full of bad jokes, but stay with me, because I'm going to take us places, okay? All right, I'm going to go with that. We're in our series of rescue. That joke needed rescue, and maybe I'll need rescuing up here this morning. But there were times in my childhood that I felt that I needed rescue. But a lot of times, I love those memories now, and I can look back and laugh about a ton of those things. But what we have, our experiences, the things that we've gone through, when we get really serious about the rescue fact, is that once we've been rescued, God has put those in us to rescue others. I firmly believe this morning, this is what I want you to take away, is what we have can rescue other people. And don't get me wrong this morning when I talk about this, is that Jesus already did the rescue. Jesus does the rescue. God is in control, and he orchestrates that. But he left us with a job to do as the church, and that's to reach others, and that's through us. And I really believe that what we have, it rescues others. But sometimes I feel like we don't know how to rescue people or how to even train. And it kind of reminds me of fighting, of boxing. And I've been a closet boxing fan most of my life. Like, I don't really let on to most people about that because I don't feel like I know enough. But man, anytime a documentary comes on about a fighter or there's information there, like, I'm locked in. And we even had, like, in high school, we had, like, this underground, like, boxing club. Like, we tried to not tell anybody about it. But, like, in my third, like, sanctioned fight, like, I knocked a kid out. And then our coach found out because we were doing it before soccer practice. And then our parents found out. And there was no more fight club because first rule of fight club is you don't talk about fight club. And it didn't go so well. But I always loved looking at these old fights. And October 1st in 1975 was one of the biggest fights ever. It was the Thrill in Manila. And Joe Frazier is taking on Muhammad Ali for the third time. Previously, they had both won a fight when they were fighting. And it was said that when they got to the ring, right when the bell rung, it was 120 degrees in there where they were fighting. And they were both going at each other, and they knew some things about each other. Joe Frazier was going to attack Ali's body and try to take his legs out. Ali was going to attack Joe Frazier's eye because he was actually blind in one eye, but he'd gotten away with it most of his career, and a lot of people didn't know that he was blind there. And so anyways, for 14 rounds, the fight just goes, and they're just pounding on each other. You can go ahead and show that clip as I talk about this, but they're just hammering on each other in this hot environment, and these are heavyweights, and so they're just going to war. And at the end of the 14th round, when the bell rings and they get into their corners, Eddie Futch, who is Joe Frazier's manager, trainer, looks at him and he says, Joe, no one will ever forget what you've done here today, but I'm throwing in the towel. And that means he would be done. Like, the fight would be over and Muhammad Ali would win. And he's like, I'm going to do it. And Joe Frazier was like, no, I want to keep fighting. But his manager, they did it. They threw in the towel. And little did they know that in Muhammad Ali's corner, Muhammad Ali was done. He says, cut my gloves off. I don't want to fight anymore. I'm spent. But his famous trainer, Angelo Dundee, said, no, I refuse. You're going to go out there for one more round. There's only one more round left in the fight. And when they finally announce Muhammad Ali as the winner, he stands up, barely able to even stand, before collapsing again on his stool. Both men reflected on that night. Joe Frazier, he said, we went to Manila champions and left as old men. Muhammad Ali said, it was like dying, the closest thing to death that I know of. Regardless of how you feel about boxing, every day that you wake up, you're in a fight. Whether you think you are or not, you're in a fight. You have an enemy that is lining up against you. He's got game film on you. He knows your weaknesses. He knows your tendencies. He knows your personality flaws. He knows how to attack you. And you know, the reason that we get to the end of the day sometimes when we feel like we've been in a fight, it's because we have been. I don't know about you, but I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I got in a lot of fights growing up. I didn't know Jesus. And I thought that I could just figure out my problems that way. And a lot of times, like I've already said, my mouth wrote checks that my fists simply couldn't cash. And I found myself in a pretty tough situation. I remember one time I was playing basketball, and it was at the center court during lunch, and a lot of people are watching. And there was this kid who was pretty small. He had really, really thick glasses, and his name was Doug. And he got picked on a lot, and this one, like, really big kid, like I said, like, I just attracted the attention of these guys, and, like, probably the strongest guy in our school. He keeps backing them down into the lane, and he's just shoving them with his back, pretty much. And finally, I was like, hey, all right, I'll guard Brady. His name was Brady. And so I get in there, and he starts doing the same to me, and he was already kind of upset that I wasn't letting him pick on Doug anymore. And so finally, like, I was like, well, this will be smart. I'll just step out of the way the next time he goes to back into me really hard, and he'll fall over. So he did. Like, I was like, whoops, and that didn't go so well. He gets up, and he punches me right in the face. For a moment, well, hey, I'm still up. Like, I just took a punch, and, like, I'm like, you know what, Brady? You're not worth it. And I grab my dress shirt, and I walk off thinking all victorious. Little did I know that, like, our teacher was watching, and I still got in-school suspension for provoking the fight. But I was like, but I was sticking up for, it didn't matter. I found myself in a situation that I wasn't ready for, and it happened really quick. But I know a lot of times that's life. We find ourselves in a position, maybe in a fight, that we're not ready for. I find myself standing in the middle of the ring. The lights come on, the bell's rung. It's time to go, and I'm not prepared. I've had no training, and I have no game plan. Every day kind of starts to feel like it's another round where I'm just stumbling back to my stool, preparing for the next beating, for the next day. And I know it might sound crazy, call me crazy, but if we're in a fight, it might do us well to learn how to fight. It would do us well to learn what we're fighting for and what we're fighting against. So let me start us off with thinking about some questions, and I love questions. I study questions. I think about them often, of how to communicate them best when I'm communicating to others. The right question can spark a great conversation. And the wrong question can then just be a yes or no, and then you just leave it there. I think the most important questions we will have in our life is, who is God and who am I? And when we figure out that first question, it paints the picture of a lot of what that second question is. But when it comes to knowing what to fight for, what we do with our lives, it's, is it a hill that's worth dying on? Because the best way to know what to live for is to know what to die for. The best way to know what to live for is to know what to die for. Maybe the only homework you need today is to go home and make a list of the things you would die for, and I recommend it being a short list because we only have this one life. Before we can be successful rescuers, we need to count the cost. That's the only way we can dive all in. Any successful survival tactician would tell you that. Have a game plan before it happens. It's something as simple as this. In our church in Tillamook, Oregon, we had this balcony, and I had the high school there that always sat on the edge of the balcony, just tempting falling over. And in my head, I was like, you know, I'm going to grab his shirt if ever he even leans back a little bit. I had a plan. It's something as simple as that we have to know what we're going to die for, because it'll define us when we enter into those rescue moments. You may be spending your life your energy on something right now, we all are. Whether it be a boat, a business, a car, a relationship, a sports team. But if someone came into your life and just put a gun to your head and was like, are you willing to die for that? You say, no way, you can have it. It's not worth it. But the sad reality is that we are dying for it. We are spending our life on it. In other words, we're fighting for something. And the question that becomes, is that thing worth dying for? Because then it means that it would be worth living for. I remember when my son Owen was born, and it was a hard labor for my wife and hard labor for him. And later that day, when they had to take him to the children's hospital, they gave me this decision. Are you going to go with him? Or are you going to go with your wife? And I knew my wife. I chose to marry her, and she graciously said yes. But my son I just met that day. And yet, the second I met him, I love you. And right after that, there's another thought. I would die for you. I would fight for you. I would do anything I could to rescue you. Right on that day, I knew. Those are no-brainers. Some things will be eternal and some things will be temporary. Me being a pastor, a coach, any of those things, those titles will fade. I'm pretty sure God won't need a pastor in heaven. It's going to be okay. There's a phrase in our culture that I just can't stand, all right? I'm a lover, not a fighter. That's just dumb. That's a dumb phrase. I'm sorry. Like, don't say that. Because here's the reality. If you love something, you'll fight for it. And if you don't fight for something, I got news for you. You didn't really love it in the first place. It's just dumb. Don't say that anymore, all right? Don't take my word for it. The Bible is saturated with language from cover to cover about fighting. Whether you like that or not, it's in there. Paul in particular loved to make references to fighting in his letters. And when writing to his understudy, his son in the faith, Timothy, he simply said this, fight the good fight of the faith. In 1 Timothy 6:12, fight the good fight of the faith. I'm pretty sure you've probably heard that. But I'm also pretty sure that Timothy didn't need much convincing that faith was worth fighting for. And Paul continues to write the same one to the church in Thessalonica. These people woke up to a battle every day, and that's where our main text is today, and that's where we've been in our series. But all of their life was permeated by institutions and practices that honored the Greek and Roman gods. But to turn away and serve the living and true God would come at a cost. It would be isolation from your family, hostility from your neighbors and friends even, and they would probably tell you that you're wasting your time. There was a heavily, heavily destructive culture around them. So much so that Paul goes on to remind them and urge them at the end of this letter and pray for them to seek Jesus and to strive for a holy life. Paul ends the letter with a hopeful prayer for the Thessalonians in chapter 5. Paul's offering encouragement and instruction as he closes the letter. And everything I talk about today, even though I might not come back to this a lot, has to do with this prayer at the end. It has to do with this encouragement that Paul offered. It has to do with where we're at in our life as believers. And if you ever need like encouragement, and I hope that this is the most powerful thing that I say up here today, and it's just reading God's word. Dear brothers and sisters, honor those who are leaders in the Lord's work. They work hard among you and give you spiritual guidance. Show them great respect and wholehearted love because of their work and live peacefully with each other. Brothers and sisters, we urge you to warn those who are lazy, encourage those who are timid, take tender care of those who are weak. Be patient with everyone. See that no one pays back evil for evil, but always try to do good to each other and to all people. Always be joyful. Never stop praying. Be thankful in all circumstances, for this is God's will for who you belong to. You belong to Christ Jesus. Do not stifle the Holy Spirit. Do not scoff at prophecies, but test everything that is said. Hold on to what is good and stay away from every kind of evil. Once rescued, our job isn't done. Our work isn't finished. There's still more work to be done. Because we shouldn't be content with just being rescued if there's more people out there that need it. If you ever watched or read Lord of the Rings, you'd be familiar with this instance where there's this king, and his name's Theoden. And there's this warrior that's in the midst of trying to convince him to go to war. And his name's Aragorn, and the king says, "I will not risk open war." And Aragorn says back to him, "Open war is upon you, whether you risk it or not." And I love that, because it's the case for us as believers too. Open war is upon us, whether we would risk it or not, whether we would accept it or not. It's true, it's there. The question isn't, are you going to be in a fight? You're already in one. The question is, are you going to fight back? You can't afford to be a pacifist in the fight that we're in. The church in Thessalonica was facing pressure from all angles. When Paul says, uses the word fight, and fight the good fight of the faith, it's actually closer to the word of agony. And if we take that definition, the definition of agony is to strain with every fiber of your being to an end goal. It was often most used in the Greek games of wrestling and boxing. Do I have any wrestlers or boxers in here this morning? Like, show of hands, anybody that's wrestled? All right, I was just going to say, like, see, wrestlers have a different mindset, okay? Like, I went to a camp in Pennsylvania one week, and I was, like, dormed with, like, a bunch of wrestlers. They have, like, no personal boundaries, and, like, also, like, they're relentless, though. They're trained early on to leave it all in the ring, leave it all in wherever their fight is. It's a different mentality, and it's relentless, and that's what Paul is getting at. We have to strain to this end goal in front of us. We have to agonize to get there. And I've seen it in sports, and I've seen it in the body, that sometimes when we go to fight the good fight of the faith, sometimes we do the enemy's work for him. We quit. We give up. We get comfortable. We surrender before the fight has even started. Actually, just happened this weekend. A boxer got in the ring, and the ring, like, they hit the bell, and he left the ring. I haven't, like, looked more, like, what happened, but, like, he just left. Paul doesn't just leave it at fight. He's specific. He says, fight the good fight of the faith, which means it's possible to fight the bad fight or the wrong fight. So what are you fighting for? What are you fighting for? You're fighting for something. What gets your maximum energy, your maximum focus, your maximum mental effort? Because that'll be what defines you when the rescue moment is in front of you. And when we take time to see what we're fighting for, or even fighting against, or fighting over, it'll reveal to us what we really love, regardless of what we say we love. Am I fighting the good fight of the faith? Paul started this letter. When he began this letter, it was to remember the conviction that they first felt when they turned away from their idols, when they turned away from this old life and pursued Jesus, King Jesus. They weren't focused on Caesar. They weren't focused on all these other Roman and Greek gods, little g's. They were focused on the God, big G. Because easy, the longer that we're Christians, the longer that we're believers, the longer that we're rescued, to lose sight of this simple faith. It's easy to lose sight of these two things. The tomb is empty, and the throne is occupied forever. Because this changes, it changes everything. My faith is based on the person at the center of those two statements, and his name is Jesus. Jesus that came to earth to save us and hung on a cross and died and rose again and now is seated on the throne. He is king and he's a good one. And the longer that we're believers, the easier it is to just lose that passion and just say it and go through the motions. And the more complex we allow our faith to become, the more confused we become. And specifically, there's two things that battle those two things that I just said that concern me as a pastor: confusing faith with a feeling, and confusing faith with knowledge. And confusing faith with a feeling, it seems like church, we have these moments that we just pursue these feelings instead of seeking Jesus. It's like falling in love with a worship song instead of falling in love with the one we're singing it to. We're seeking out warm, fuzzy feelings from a God of our preferences that would never, ever tell us to stop doing something we don't want to, and he would definitely never tell us to start doing something we don't want to do. It's manufacturing a God of our liking instead of pursuing a God that's just in reality. It's a preference for spiritual experiences at the expense of studying the Bible, because studying the actual Bible would require actual effort, and that doesn't make me feel good. And to be honest and vulnerable with you, church, like, I struggled this summer reading my Bible. It's affected my walk. Sometimes I don't feel like I can admit that. But my feelings, they come and go, and I need to be grounded, because faith needs to be grounded on a person, and his name is Jesus. And feelings will come and go, ebb and flow. But Jesus, he doesn't change. Confusing faith with knowledge, it's on the other side of it. See, because people, it's possible to know the Bible, but not know the God of the Bible. It happens all the time. You see, because just knowing stuff about God puts us on an even par with Satan. James covers it in 2:19. He says, "Say you have faith, for you believe that there is one God. Good for you. Even the demons believe this, and they tremble and tear." I fear that a specific danger of where we live in a small conservative town, and we've kind of created a mini Bible belt, is that we've become educated about the Bible, but it's beyond our level of obedience. We know a lot of stuff, but we don't do anything, that sometimes we can get caught up in the distance between Jerusalem and Jericho and not really knowing Jesus. It happens when we are more interested with having theological debates and intramural competitions among other Christians rather than living amongst lost and broken people who Jesus came to seek and save. Jesus referred to this dynamic as straining out a gnat through your throat while trying to swallow a camel. Getting really concerned with small things when we're missing huge things. We can know a lot of stuff about the Bible, we know a lot of stuff about faith, but we don't put it into any practice. Talking about practice, in sports, it's the dynamic of a practice player. Somebody that's really, really good in training, but when the lights come on and it's game time and there's an audience, they can't pull it together. In fighting, I'm sure there's guys in the training room and that you spar with that are just absolute monsters. But once that bell rings and the time is going, like, and the fight comes, they can't deliver. The idea is to show up on game time. The idea is to show up when it counts. The idea is to be a rescuer. And that takes some sacrifice and some uncomfortable moments. Paul referred to it in another letter of his in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 26, and he says, "I don't box as one beating the air." It's a shadow boxing reference. Say this, all fighters shadow box, but not all shadow boxers fight. Shadow boxing is just when you're going through the motions. You're not fighting anybody. It's just, you've seen boxers do that. It's just practice. I don't want to be a part of a church at times where we're just full of shadow boxers. You see, followers of Jesus who just fill up all their time with Christian activity, they're shadow boxing. Look, Bible studies are awesome. And I love so much of what our church is doing. And I love my life group, and there's a lot of things that are really good, but if we aren't putting into action, then we're missing the point of what we're studying in the Bible. Our punches don't pack anything. We're not packing punches. We're just punching the air. Because the thing about shadow boxing is that no one punches back. It's easy to study what Jesus says. It's a whole entire different thing to live it out. The great theologian Mike Tyson put it this way. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. It's true. I had a class that covered evangelism in Bible college. Classes on evangelism are different than actually doing it. Classes are neat and tidy and organized, and they have answers for different things, but people are not neat, not tidy. They're messy, they're broken, and they're lost. They're all over the place. All the Sunday school classes, Bible studies, and books on Christian living are good things. Don't hear me saying anything else, but don't miss this. It's shadow boxing. It's preparing for the real thing. They can be good things if it gets to the real thing, but unfortunately, we do a lot of training, and we actually never do a lot of fighting. And Paul and Jesus would have never wanted it this way. protecting our own at the expense of lost and broken people who don't know Jesus. Because he would tell us, I would put it this way, Jesus didn't die to build a church that was more concerned with who it's trying to keep than who it's trying to reach. It's not what he died for. His last words on earth weren't about protect what you have. He said, go to the ends of the earth, proclaiming the good news that I've given you. Deliver good news to lost and broken people. You want to know the, like, one of the most like mature faith things that I've been a part of? And it's been in the last year. It's been here. It's been something very simple that we do that I feel like sometimes it can be overlooked. Building a wheelchair ramp. It's that simple. Somebody came to us like, hey, I can't get into my house because I have stairs and I have a wheelchair. What do I do? We'll build it for you. We'll build it. Simple faith is deep faith. James 2:14 through 17 says this, what good is it, dear brothers and sisters, if you have faith but you don't show it by your actions? Can that kind of faith save anyone? We're trying to rescue. Suppose you see a brother or sister who has no food or clothing, and you say, goodbye, have a good day, stay warm and eat well. But then you don't give that person any food or clothing. What good does that do? So you see, faith by itself isn't enough unless it produces good deeds. It is dead and useless. It's shadow boxing. You know, I've only been in youth ministry for 7 years. One of my pet peeves when I just hear it in the church is when somebody's like, you know, I just want to go deeper. Oftentimes, not every time, but oftentimes that just means I just want to accumulate more knowledge, but not do anything. I've been a Christian for 10 years, and I can only speak for myself, but I know in my life, I need a whole lot more action and a lot less talk. Talk is cheap. You hear that in the fighting ring all the time. And those that I have in my life that have a richness and a deepness and a vitality to their faith, it's lived out in simple things. It's the way they live, the way they treat people, the way they speak to people, the way they pray, the way they laugh, the way they smile, the way they share, the way they interact with people who don't know Jesus. And you know who it reminds me of? Jesus. There's two things you need to remember. The tomb is empty and the throne is occupied. Heaven and hell are real, and if they aren't, we shouldn't be here. We shouldn't be here this morning. We should be out enjoying northern Michigan in the summertime. But if they are, then we've entered into a fight, and our work is not done. There's still a rescue that needs to happen. James talks about it later in his chapter, and he says, talking about, like, don't talk about tomorrow or next year we'll go into such and such a town and do such and such a thing. We don't know what tomorrow holds. What if the fear settled in today that you didn't want to get to heaven and have things left over? You don't want to get to heaven and be like, God, you know what? I had something I could have gave. You know, I could have supported that cause. I had talent that you gave me. But you know what? God's not going to use your creativity in heaven. I'm pretty confident he has it covered and he has way more creativity than us because he's the author of that. He is the creator. You can't use your money in heaven. You can't use your wisdom in heaven. And you can't use that verse that's on your heart to tell your friend in heaven. Because once we get to heaven, we're there. We're there. But God gave you what you have now to give to somebody else. That you would be willing to fight every day because you don't want to get to heaven and have something left on you. I want to get to heaven and have nothing. And be like, yo, I had to borrow somebody else's change just to get here. Because I used up all my talent. I used up all my passion. I used up all my dreams. I have nothing. I have nothing left. I'm broke. And I was just hoping it would get here. And you know why God created sleep? Because you should be tired at the end of the day. I promise you, you don't want to get to heaven and have things left. That piece, the piece of the puzzle that could be somebody's missing piece of their puzzle for their salvation. It could be in your pocket today. That thing you went through, that thing you experienced, or just your personality could be the thing separating somebody else from God. And they're hoping, they're praying you don't give up. You don't wake up, you don't get in the ring, and when that bell rings, you just step out, and they're like, I can't do it. I'm not ready. Hear this, there's more opportunity in your life than you think there is. And there's more ability to reach people in you right now than you think there is. Jesus gave it all so that you could give it away. Let this mask of Christianity go. Let the Spirit of God lead us in a fight. Fight the good fight. Increase your love. Be like Jesus and keep it simple. Paul, when he said, fight the good fight of the faith, imagine him at the end of his life writing that. The scars and scars and scars on his back. From the times he's been flogged, the bones that were crooked because they didn't reset right, because he's been beaten with rods, his nose had been broken more times than he could remember. Raw spots on his wrists and his ankles, arthritic knees, broken knuckles. And who Paul would have looked like? An old fighter. I want to go out swinging. I want to live every day and pour it out to the way that he did to the early church. I want to agonize toward the end of this goal because there's still more that needs to be rescued, and we can't quit, church. We can't be comfortable. It's one of the biggest dangers that we'll ever face. You guys pray with me? Father God, I thank you for this morning. I thank you for your word. I thank you for Paul's encouragement to the church in Thessalonica that we can still focus on today. And I pray that we would use that. We won't be good with just being okay. Or that we would fight against that. Could be real, authentic, and trusting with others, with our struggles, with our problems, with our hurts and wants and desires and dreams. We'd come together as a body with one heart to want to rescue others. Because we know that there's a ton more out there in Kalkaska and the surrounding counties that need that hope, need that light, need the peace that you offer and the joy that you provide. All right, thank you for sending your son. And I pray, I'm sorry that at times that we complicate things that are simple. So in your name I pray. Amen.